Big transfer news today.
Who's moving?
Me. To the couch. With Domino's best deal ever since they just added stuffed crust.
Any pizza, any toppings, now with stuffed crust for $9.99.
It's a long-term contract with no release clause.
Only $9.99? Yeah, that sounds like the move. I'm heading straight to
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6/15 through 7/26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings, 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 28. In which Bob welcomed friend and colleague and fellow podcaster Aaron from Generation Y and The Framed podcast to talk about his season 3 of Framed, the conversation and case around Temujin Kensu. We are sans Zach today. I'm sorry to say we keep missing each other. We will miss him. But before we get started, do we have any other housekeeping?
I don't believe so. I know everybody's waiting with bated breath for our DNA results from the West Memphis 3 case. All I can tell you is they said July. They gave us a hard July. It's July 20th today. So fingers crossed in the next couple weeks, hopefully we will have those results. Other than that, no housekeeping. I can't even tell you who I think is going to be on the podcast this week because I have 5 different people that I'm reaching out to and in communication with, and I haven't narrowed down which one is going to be the one for this week. So hopefully one of them is. Otherwise, it'd be me talking about how I don't have a guest.
Got it. Fingers crossed.
And I guess, too, that's a good... We talked about this in the pregame. I just mentioned it here, that I am still working, trying to find a case. I have one that I'm real on the fence about. I keep running into cases that have been pitched to me that I start digging into them. Every time I think it's going to be the right one, it turns out not to be. I either find something where I think that they're probably guilty or there's just not enough evidence that they're not, and I don't want to do a podcast that's and at the end of the day, there's reason, that's why, Richard Allen's case and all the, obviously that one's covered by a lot of media and he has attorneys and all that too. But also it was if my conclusion is going to be I'm not comfortable with the trial and there's reasonable doubt, that's not what I do. The case that I want us to take on is one where I believe based on the evidence, the person is actually innocent and we're going to fight for their freedom and fight for justice and fight to find the right person. And I just have not, it's hard. I keep getting, every time I listen to a new podcast and have somebody on, I keep thinking how do they keep finding these cases? But then again, also you hear, nobody we've had on, but a lot of times these cases go out and then everybody's like, well, they're not telling you this, this, and this, and they really think they are guilty. So maybe that's part of it, but I try very hard not to do that. But
yeah,
man, it's been tough finding a good case, but just know this, we're still working on it. In the meantime, as I keep saying, I've been enjoying what we're doing this season. I'm learning a lot, getting to talk to a lot of cool people. So, and it seems like for the most part, everybody's still enjoying that. So we'll just keep plugging away and keep searching for that next case. With that said, let's talk about this one. This is a case that everybody...
I'm so sorry. If you don't mind, I was going to say, this is actually a great... What you just said is a great segue into this episode because you just said there are these kind of circumstances and qualifications that you're looking for when you look for a case to cover. And one of the things is you want a case of actual innocence and you don't want to spend all this time looking into it only to determine that the person may well be guilty, even if they didn't get a fair trial. And I think this is one of those potentially controversial cases because it falls not just into that category, but also into the category of how do you reckon with a person who you might not like at all being a victim of the system, but having potentially done all of these other things that makes it harder to, again, fight. Yes, fight for fair trials, fight for fair convictions for everyone. But if you are an independent content creator who is really trying to make a difference, who doesn't have, you know, 2020's money or whatever, like, you're putting a tremendous investment into something. I think you are entitled to want to believe in the humanity and goodness of a person as well. That is a choice that you are allowed to make. And I think this is a really interesting case because, as Aaron hinted at in your conversation, a lot of people don't like this guy. I don't think Aaron likes this guy.
I'm not sure Aaron likes him very much.
Yeah, I think he's playing it close to the chest a little bit as he introduces and the story unfolds. But I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from my conversations with him, too, I mean, I certainly haven't got the impression from Aaron that he's a good guy. He's misunderstood. He needs to be released. It's not that at all. I actually really applaud Aaron because this is, you and I know Aaron. I don't know how well you know.
I don't know Aaron at all. I would say I don't know either. I mean, I've been a long time listener, as many have, to Generation Y. So, but I don't think he knows me.
I've known him for a long time, like, on a personal level. I can see, like, he's a friend. You know, and Aaron is such a good guy. Like, he is the guy who, if you shoot him a text about something, he'll say, "Hey, give me a call," always. And you're never gonna have a texting conversation with Aaron. And we talked for over an hour about just about all kinds of stuff. Way before we recorded this interview, just catching up. Aaron, he's got a big heart. He's very much interested in the truth and in justice, and he does not like drama. He does not like getting sucked into your typical online drama and fighting and bickering. So I really applaud him for taking this on, because he knew, and we talked about it, like he knew that Temujin Kenzu is a divisive. Isn't even divisive implies there's some people that there's a lot of people that love him and a lot of people that hate him. I think for the most part, most people don't care for this guy, and for seemingly good reason. Even a lot of people who believe in his innocence will acknowledge that, you know, he's not, you know, generally considered, you know, and I don't know enough. I don't want to speak it as fact, but he's generally, from what I've seen and read, most people don't think that he's a good person. There's been, you know, sexual assault allegations and abuse allegations and all these different things that come along with him. But Aaron is, you know, he wants to really dig into the facts and look. And there's this, you hit it exactly right. It's tricky as a content creator, because as a justice warrior, my concern is that our criminal justice system is operating honestly and fairly, and that we are not convicting people of crimes they didn't commit. Also, as a content creator, it's like, but if this guy's an asshole and abusive and a horrible person, do I want to commit my energy into helping someone like that? And I know that, like the truth of the matter is, if you're trying to find out who actually did something, you know, you're really fighting for the victim, but there's still that other element. It's tough. And I don't think it should be assumed that Aaron doesn't realize it's tough and didn't realize that when he took this on and he chose to do it anyway.
Yeah, I guess I'm really curious, because I don't think you guys talked about it. I really apologize if you did. I think I definitely listened to the episode once. I believe I listened to it twice, or I listened to at least 1.5 times. I don't remember him kind of getting into, and perhaps he will during the season, or maybe he won't, but, like, I don't actually really know why, with all of the coverage. Again, that this is another example of exactly what you said, like, that you're looking for a case that hasn't had a lot of coverage. This has had a lot of coverage over the years.
Yeah.
And in-depth coverage in many cases. And so I'm so interested. I'm not judging Aaron for picking it. But just genuinely very, very curious kind of what stoked the fire on this for him, why he felt, like, compelled to, like, okay, you know what? Frame needs to also take this on. We need to bring, you know, what we bring to it.
Yeah. And I feel like we had that conversation off air in the conversation the day before, because I was kind of curious about that too, like, why he decided to take. And if I remember correctly, and I think he'll probably talk about this later in the podcast. And so, you know, that don't rely on what I'm saying, but it was something to the extent of where the case was brought to him. He was looking at it. And I think that part of it was, there's all this media coverage of it, but so much of the media coverage like focuses on Temujin Kensu as a person instead of the facts of the case. And he really wants to talk about the facts of the case. And we mentioned one of our, I think Brandon, one of our listeners had mentioned like Undisclosed did a season or a short season on this case. But that would, but apparently there was new information that has come out since then. I think there were like in 2024, 2025, there was more information that came out. I think that's when Aaron originally got interested in the case because there was more than just what came out then.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, again, just as far as what I remember, from what I remember from Undisclosed, I don't remember a ton about who he was as a person. And it seemed like it was very much focused on, in particular, the alibis.
Yeah, that's what I guess I didn't. And that put, was, I didn't point out the contrast I was trying to make was that theirs was focused on the case.
Yeah. But like the murder sheet has done tons of episodes on it and they've broken down the evidence. But I think they've also, and I don't want to misspeak. And I think, you know, like Kevin would totally come on. I don't want to speak for Anya because I don't know Anya, but I know Kevin. I'm sure at some point I will know Anya. But I think, you know, they were experiencing my sense from the episodes that I've listened to is that they were kind of experiencing the opposite, which was that there was all of this focus on the case from a perspective of the alibis being like very much front and center. And that's the log line, right, that you hear about. If you just hear about this case in passing, someone's like, yeah, this dude lived all the way over here in Michigan and he was supposed to have gone all the way to there in Michigan. Like, and he had to like somehow, you know, he would have had to take a private plane and like, the you know, they're just, and he had all these alibis. It's crazy. Like, that's the sort of like log line if you, you know, believe in his innocence. And agreed with Aaron and you guys in your conversation. And also what Murder Sheet, I think, really brought to the table is like they really wanted to give voice to people who are potentially other victims, living victims of this person, and kind of not, you know, not saying like, listen, there's a reason that this guy was convicted and it may not be, you know, don't look at the jury and go, you guys are out of your minds. Like, here's the stuff that was presented, and that character stuff did come in there, but that character stuff starts to feel important if you're a person who was victimized by someone who is in the headlines and that it seems like a clear-cut case of X, that it can be potentially re-traumatizing to that person to be like, oh my God, this guy's a hero now? He did X, Y, and Z to me. No one's talking about that. You know what I mean? So I appreciate that like focus too.
Yeah. And I think that's, and I'm hoping, and just everybody knows, like I did, we've got a long question about this. So we'll get, well, we're kind of already getting into it. But I did reach out to Murder Sheet, and Janet has talked to them in email separately. We found out during the pregame that we both have had communication. Well, I sent a message. I haven't heard back yet.
Yeah, a little Instagram note. Yeah.
Yeah. And but Janet has actually emailed with Kevin, said he would come on. So that's my hope, is to have them come on to kind of get the others. Because that's what it seems to me. Again, this is not a case I'm super familiar with.
Same.
I've been doing a lot of research on it in the last couple of days to kind of get ready for this. And I did, you know, some prep work before I interviewed with Aaron. But yeah, there seemed to be like kind of two sides of it. There's the side where people are looking at, like, say, the alibi, which is the big, you know, stanchion of the innocence argument. And they tend to not want to talk about, you know, the other parts of Temujin Kensu and all the bad things he's done to all these other people that seem to be, you know, close to confirmed. I mean, they're at least, you know, the people are speaking directly to the things he's done to them. And then there's like the other side of it where there's a lot of focus on that and less focus on the alibi. Now, for me, normally when I'm looking at it, it's like, well, if I'm looking at this case, did this person murder this person? There is, you know, a lot of the things that, and I haven't listened, to be fair, I have not listened to the Murder Sheet's coverage on it.
I didn't know that they had done so much cover. I was aware of a conversation that they had with Brett from the prosecutors and Julia from the consult, and then Julia from the consult, by the way, is a bonus episode in Framed. Aaron also had a conversation with her about this, and they are, of course, former behavioral analysts, and do analysis. And so, yeah, they've had conversations, but I did not realize that they had done this, you know, really extensive, multiple episodes, long, very thorough episodes, as they've dug into some of that. And I can't speak to that either. I'm behind.
Yeah. I mean, I've read some of what's been talked about on those episodes, but I haven't read it yet. But that seems like there's you know, like a lot of the stuff, it seems like they've covered along those lines really speaks a lot to character and motive, but it doesn't seem to speak a lot to actual evidence of the murder.
They have an episode that is like kind of what we did with Pinyon Pines, where if you just need to point to one, and thanks, Kevin, for sending this to me. And unfortunately, I didn't have quite enough time to fully listen to it. As everyone knows, my work life is like a crunch zone right now. It's so crazy. But there is an episode that you can listen to that's like, here's the evidence, not just of who this person is, but of like what was presented, what's argued against it. And it's a long one. It's like a couple hours that they created as a kind of like, here's a cheat, not cheat sheet, but like, here's a, you know, here's a quick, you can digest this and sort of get a sense of like all of the coverage that they did do. But, you know, the conversation that they had with Julia and with Brett, I not recommend that, people who don't want to, sometimes there's some smack talk, but there was, especially with Julia, in my opinion, very respectful conversation about how we all perceive, how we choose to perceive, how all of us, anybody, no matter what, we choose to perceive evidence or facts or, you know, reporting. And sometimes it's the actual fact that feels like subjective. It's like an objective fact can actually be looked at somewhat subjectively, because sometimes it's a fact that you can either put in one pile or put in the other pile, and the fact stays the same, but what you think it means changes. And so that can get, you know, really hard. That interpretation is so key to, I think, people agreeing and disagreeing on cases. And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And I really appreciate the respect that I've seen paid to people in these various communities, at least on the podcasting side. I can't speak to like comments and stuff like that. But you know, the people are saying like, hey, I respect that you disagree with me on this. And that doesn't mean that, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, or that you're just, you know, like you're just wrongly interpreting this. Because sometimes it really is kind of like, well, where does this fall for you? If you're leaning this way, you can kind of use that way. If you're leaning the other way, you can use it this way. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I struggle with this because I'm very curious to see what Aaron's going to do, because in what I have come to sort of understand about this guy, I guess there is this part of me that's like, there's got to be somebody out there who hasn't had any attention paid and is like also a good person and real, like, you know, they can't all be Ed Eights, mm-hmm. but we're very spoiled by like some special folks being, you know, right. Like really deserving another chance. And I'm being challenged myself by ethically kind of going, boy, this is, you know, we keep talking about this guy. Just, I don't know if I'm not, I'm not as passionate about him.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm torn about it, because it's like, if our goal is true criminal justice reform, like, I think there is a value in spending time on a case that, you know, it's in the media because people are interested in it. And if you, you know, it's like, so if you have more eyes and ears paying attention to if there was an injustice, that, you know, it's like, I try very hard to like step away. You know, again, I wouldn't cover the case, but, you know, when somebody else is doing something like this, to step away from, okay, let's not think, I don't want to think about or worry about this guy, or what does this mean on a broader scale? What are we okay with a prosecutor and a jury and a system doing? Are we okay with them convicting and sending somebody to prison for the rest of their life if they didn't do something because they're a bad guy? And I think the answer for most people is like, it should be no.
Right.
Right. So I think there's a value in the fact that you know, he could go pick. Okay. And again, he's not, you know, Aaron's not me. He doesn't have innocence networks, and, you know, he's not known for innocence work where he's got people, you know, pitching cases to him all the time. You know, he primarily does Generation Y, where they cover a whole wide range of cases, mostly cases that are popular cases. So he's just in a different world. So it's like, he doesn't have a Google submission form with hundreds of cases that people are pitching to him to work off of. So I get how, in the world he lives in, how he lands on it. I think that I can't confidently speak one way or the other on the case. If this was truly a misjustice, then it does. I think it does. It forces us to have a conversation that's probably a little uncomfortable. You know, it's like, am I willing to stand by my principles and what I believe needs to happen to fix this system, even when the person that it involves is not someone that I want to help? It's the middle of summer, and between long days outside, workouts, travel, and nights when the house never seems to cool down, good sleep can be hard to come by. You climb into bed tired, but your body just won't switch off. What a lot of people don't realize is that sweating through those hot summer days can also drain your magnesium. It's important to know because magnesium is one of the nutrients your body relies on to relax, recover, and get healthy sleep. That's why I keep Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers on my nightstand all summer long. Magnesium is one of the key nutrients your body relies on for relaxation, recovery, and healthy sleep, and most people simply aren't getting enough. What makes Magnesium Breakthrough different is that it packs multiple bioavailable forms of magnesium into one capsule, instead of just the one or two you'll find in most supplements. So when you're coming off a long travel day, bouncing back from a hot, active afternoon, or just trying to actually sleep through a warm night, this is the simplest habit to come back to. And here's what you get when you go to bioptimizers.com/truth and use code TRUTH. You're going to get 15% off your entire order, plus a free travel-size bottle of Masszymes, Bioptimizer's best-selling digestive enzyme added to your order automatically when you use our exclusive code TRUTH. That's a $20 product, free on top of the 15% discount. This is a limited time offer and while supplies last. You cannot get this on Amazon. You can't get it in stores. This offer exists in one place. My link, my code, that's it. Bioptimizers.com/truth and use code TRUTH. Bioptimizers. Breakthrough science, results you can feel. If you like casino games, DraftKings Casino is giving new players a lot more flexibility on how they use their spins. Instead of locking you into one slot, FlexSpins lets you choose from more than 100 different games. That means you can try different favorites and decide where you want to play. DraftKings Casino changed the game with exclusive FlexSpins. Now you can choose how to use your spins across more than 100 different slots. New casino players play $5 and get 1,000 flex spins. Claim 50 spins a day for 20 days. Then you choose how to play across your favorite games like Huff and More Puff, Cash Eruption, and more. Download the app and sign up with code TRUTH to claim 1,000 flex spins on your choice of slots. The crown is yours. In partnership with DraftKings Casino, gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. 21 plus. Physically present in Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia only. Void in Ontario. Eligibility restrictions apply. Non-withdrawable spins issued as 50 spins per day for 20 days. Valid for select games only and expire each day after 24 hours. See terms at casino.draftkings.com/promos. Ends July 22nd at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time.
This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I totally agree, and I can't speak for anyone else, but I don't think anyone is saying, like, I think that this was, you know, an injustice, but let him rot. I don't, I mean, I'm sure there are many people saying that, I don't think anyone I know or anyone that I understand to have covered it comes at it from that perspective at all. But there is this kind of underlying thing where even people who believe that he may not have done this are like, boy, he just can't not screw up his own innocence work. Like, he can't not burn bridges. Yeah. He can't not blow up at people who are trying to help him and like end those relationships. And, you know, that's just all stuff that, you know, doesn't help when you kind of take it, you know, into account holistically. Oh, man, I was like, I've got the perfect thing to say next. And naturally, I can't think of, oh, I know what it is. I'm so curious. The thing that I haven't, that I don't, I'm sure Undisclosed talked about, and I am very sure that Murder Sheet will have talked about, and I just haven't gotten to it yet. And it's possible that even in the recent conversation that they had with their colleagues, that they get to it, and I just haven't finished, because it was a two-parter, I haven't finished the second part. But in my opinion, and I know we also have stuff to get into with listeners, I just keep thinking, like, couldn't this have been, like, maybe his alibis are real and he worked very carefully to construct them because he had a friend who did him a favor. I don't know. You know, I can't recall where the could he have gotten someone else to do it thing factors in. And maybe the answer is like, yeah, it could have happened, but we have no proof of that. So we have to say he couldn't have done it. But there's also people who believe that, you know, he absolutely could have manipulated those alibis and convinced people into thinking they were thinking of a day that they weren't and stuff like that. I think that's a big for him to have been the human being who was there on site, who pulled the trigger. But I'm just curious if, like, you know, and I'm sure, again, if I knew the case better, and I'm sure I'll have an answer to this in a couple of weeks or less, what the idea is behind if the only known motive out there with extensive other research is we genuinely can't find anyone else who would have done this. And it seems very deliberate and planned, then I guess I come back to, like, well, you know, as you know, Bob, there's a case in my family that I'm too close to. And that is a constant question, is like, it doesn't necessarily have to have been this person. It could have been someone close to this person who took care of it, so to speak.
Right.
But can you connect those dots legally, you know?
Well, in this case, it's did they connect those dots? And that's, you know, that's where my questions come in. Let's I know we got a couple of questions outside of the case, and we can just kind of summarize those real quick, because I think, like, Kathy just kind of talking about eyewitness identification.
Sure. Yeah, I can start. Well, I'll do that for sure. Kathy shares an anecdote about this kind of unreliability of eyewitnesses, as we hear time and again. But Kathy says, not a question, but something I learned at CrimeCon. When XG was still involved, I guess that's a crime con thing. I don't know much about crime con, sorry, is how eyewitness identification be so wrong. I was watching a seminar with Tim Clementi and I think Bobby Chacon, who are very funny, went off to my right. A few rows down, two people started arguing, drawing our attention. Then to my left, a few rows back, two people started fighting. While those two things were going on, the two ladies in front of me started yelling each other and pushing each other and struggling into the aisle. There was a big bang and the lights went out. When they came on, one lady was laying on the ground, and Tim asked if anyone saw anything. Five different people went up on stage to tell what they saw, and they all saw something different. This happened just feet from me, and I never saw the quote-unquote knife. All I could tell you was that the blonde lady wearing a black shirt and the dark lady was wearing a white shirt. There were so many distractions all around us, and it happened so fast. Of course, this was a setup to show how you really can't put too much faith in eyewitness testimony. It was a real eye-opener for me. I will say that sounds like they made a lot of stuff happen all at once, Kathy. I was, like, overwhelmed. Yeah. I'm like, whoa, they had, like, three altercations suddenly going on.
Yeah, it doesn't take that much. Even I've done this with my investigative journalism class on a much simpler note. I've done it two different times, and I had to have one person in the room that knew what was going on so they could give directions about me coming back. But both times I grabbed somebody. I'm like, hey, I'm going to do this. When I'm done, when I leave the room, I want you to give everybody this piece of paper and have them fill it out. Okay. And so then, like, right when everybody comes in, they sit down, I say, okay, everybody get, and then I start yelling at one of the students and they start yelling back at me. And then they throw a piece of paper at me and I grab it and I throw it at somebody else. And I blurt something out as I run out of the room and slam the door. It's just like this, it's just a chaos for like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And then I give them all the question. This is, give me a witness statement, include what was said. What was the person, you know, what was Mr. Ruff wearing? What, like, all these very specific questions. you know, was he wearing glasses? Like all these different things. And then there's no talking allowed, and the student is instructed to give them all the thing. You're not allowed to talk. Everybody fill it out, put it on Mr. Ruff's desk, and then they come out in the hall and get me when they're done. And then I sit down and read them all. And just that little interaction, it's like, this person says I was wearing a yellow shirt. This person says I was wearing a gray shirt. This person says I was wearing glasses. This person says I wasn't wearing glasses. This person says I had shaved my beard. This one says I had a beard. You know, it doesn't take much. If you don't know that you need to be recording and watching something, which is almost every time when a situation like this happens, and when there's an emergency happens, you're not like, oh, here's something I need to remember. It's like it happens, and then you're trying to remember. And yeah, there's a reason eyewitness testimony sucks.
No, for sure. I'll go one step further and say, very recently, I had a moment in my neighborhood where I heard a strange sound, and I didn't know what it was. And I was walking my dog, and then this guy came out kind of from where it seemed like maybe I had heard the sound. Now, mind you, I live in a canyon, so anything could be coming from anywhere at any given time. Yeah. But this guy came out, and it was just like some white dude, like no big deal, middle age, like nothing, you know. But I just had this moment where, you know, because of stuff like this that we talk about, I was like, I'm just going to remember him. I'm just going to remember him. Like, I'm sure nothing will come of this. I'm just going to remember him. And I like made a mental note, and I like over a couple of times over, like sort of chanted to myself, like what he was wearing, kind of what color hair he was, how tall I thought he was, how much I thought he weighed. And this was only last week. And of course, no one asked or ever asked me anything. And yesterday, all of a sudden, because I was walking past the same place, and he crossed my mind, and I was like, oh, I don't remember anything.
Like, nothing. I got nothing.
And I remember, I think he had a red shirt. That is so unhelpful. Like, right. It was gone. And I meant to remember. I told myself I should remember this just in case. And I still forgot.
Yeah.
So that's not good.
And that's very well demonstrated in the case that we're talking about, because I was, you know, all the eyewitnesses had so many different versions of what happened, because that's just how this is what happens with eyewitnesses. That's why they're not powerful evidence at all. They generally don't sway me, just to the same extent of, you know, you always hear me in all of our cases, if like somebody is like giving a time or a day, something happened, like I was like, I need to know that in anchor. Like, I don't believe you if you tell me I remember this happened at 9 o'clock p.m. I remember if you tell me I remember I was in the middle of watching this show and it just started and I started making popcorn. And right when I got the popcorn out of the microwave, it happened. Like, now we can tie that to a real time. But like, people don't remember times and dates and faces and the things people are wearing unless they have a reason to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and I would say, I mean, I guess it's fair to have the conversation, and I'm not saying this makes it reliable all the time, but like, there are things, like you say, that factor in that can speak more towards like viability. Like if it's someone that, you know, if it's just you and that person alone on a street and you know them because they're your neighbor, you know, even then sometimes you can't trust it, but that, you know, there are things that help it boost its reliability. But if it's a crowded area, a day that's just an ordinary day for people, and they're talking about someone they don't, you know, necessarily know, that can be really tricky. And that's definitely something that, you know, folks have said about this case, like, I have to throw that away because I can't trust based on these scenarios. And I think Aaron does get into that, right, in the first couple of episodes. What it seems that happened initially then changed over time, or changed after a certain type of conversation with law enforcement or whatever, that stuff that you kind of have to, that it raises red flags for some folks, you know.
Well, a big one was like, that I remember was like the license plate.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, that would be odd to remember. And then when he gives like five different versions, or however
the
many
hypnotism
different versions,
thing is a real problem. Yeah, that feels like a problem.
Yeah. And then eventually you end up, it was like, that's not a thing that you thought the license plate said this, and then they were hypnotized and it changed to this. And eventually you come up with like, it's not, I don't think it's really a thing that, you know, all this time later, you're like, oh, wait, now I remember.
Right.
It was EJM, not QRZ.
Right. Right. Sarah A. had just voiced some concerns about the family. She says, I understand the sentiment behind putting the victim first, but I wonder if the family is consulted before a podcast speaks on behalf of their loved one. Were Scott's family members asked if they were happy for his name to be promoted in yet another podcast about Temujin? I don't think I'd like my husband or son's memory to be unable to rest. Off the top of my head, I can think of 7 podcasts that have covered this case. I just think Scott should be left alone now, and I truly wish podcasts with big audiences would use their voice for others in prison who have no support navigating the system.
Yeah, that kind of speaks. Some of that is what we were talking about earlier. But as far as the victim's family, that's always a tough one. I struggle with that one, too. And I always reach out to the victim's families in the cases we do. But I got to admit, like a lot of the times in the cases that we're covering, the victim's family either won't get back with me or they don't support what we're doing. And then you have to ask yourself the question, do I not help this person that I believe it? Let's not talk about Temujin's case,
right,
Kenzu's
right.
case. Let's just talk about it. But just in general, do I not help this person that I genuinely believe was wrongfully convicted? And do I not try to find the real killer of this victim because a surviving family member doesn't want it talked about? And for me, I usually land on, like, if I'm, you know, Jody's case is a perfect example. There was no, you know, I couldn't get a response from family members from DeMario at the beginning. Later, actually, after the season was over, one of his family members did reach out and she was pissed. But then once we talked about it, you know, she actually apologized and was glad that we did it. But it was one of those, like, I'm so certain that Jody is innocent and that the real killer can be caught and that Jody does not deserve to be in prison. I feel for and understand the feeling from the family members, but I can't let that stop me from doing what I think is right, I'm uncomfortable even just like giving that explanation here, because it's a hard decision to make.
Yeah, but I think it's important for us to continue to touch base with that, you know, because I know that there are people who think that part of innocence work means that you're just careless and you don't give a shit about the victim's family. And that's just, I can't speak for everyone, but I would stake my life on it with you. I know that's not how you are. That's not how it is. I just know that. I know that that is not what this is about. There's just no carelessness around that. It's hard and it's such a tough decision. And the idea of part of the work being, I have to be comfortable being uncomfortable, like, because it'll never feel comfortable knowing that a victim's family thinks you are a problem and that you are ruining a perfectly good conviction and that you are causing unrest in the person who deserves peace in their afterlife. However you want to think about that, that you are doing harm, that you have to know, I'm never going to feel okay about that. I'm never going to feel good about someone believing that about me. And yet I have to move forward. And that's one of the things that's really hard for me, because I never want to hurt anyone's feelings.
Right.
I always want people to, like, it's so hard to let go of the idea of, like, but maybe I can just convince them that I really do mean the best. I really do. I'm thinking about their family member. At some point, you know, you just have to be okay with that not being okay. And I find that very challenging.
Yeah, me too. And another, like, perfect example of that, I didn't think it was just popped in my head. Like the West Memphis 3 case, like right now. So the, you know, Michael's parents, the Moores, they have for all these years, for 33 years now, have said Damian, Jason, and Jesse are guilty. They are convinced of it. They are 100% certain. They are pissed off about all the media that they're getting and all the stuff that's going on. And I've always known that, and it's always been a difficult thing. But then I wonder, like, when we get these DNA results back, if there's meaningful results and if it results in us finding the actual killer, I'm really curious, like, how they'll, because that's not as simple as you think. Like I don't think it's as, not you, Janet, but like just the general you, it's not as simple, I don't think, as being like, oh, well, now we got the right person. Good. Like making that mental shift is got to be very, very difficult. And so that's one of the things that's kind of been in the back of my mind with this case. Like, we may actually solve this case. And then you have the Moores who, because now on to think about them. Let's say that we get DNA results and there's a serial killer's DNA all over every one of those ligatures. And they go out and they grab that serial killer and they put him in prison, and Damian, Jason, and Jesse's names are cleared. Now they had accepted the closure that they had. Now they have this new closure to deal with. They actually caught the right person. But there has to be some amount of probably now guilt that they have because of all the things they've been saying about these other three this whole time. And maybe even the stuff they've been saying about, like, it, not that I don't know that they've ever said anything about me. I have no idea. But let's say they were, you know, they've been saying, you know, Bob Ruff is an asshole and he shouldn't even be doing this. And they're saying, you know, like, there's so many layers to it that, you know, when I'm confident that we're going to get a resolution to this case, and it's going to open up and unravel a lot more. It's not going to be as simple as like, ha, finally we got him. I think there's going to be a lot of folks that are, you know, connected to the case that's still going to be difficult for them. It's probably even getting the right answer could still open up new wounds.
Well, and I would go further and say, you know, with the research done on things like conspiracy theories, which, you know, everybody likes to, you know, scoff at other people's conspiracy theories. And that's something that, you know, is like used in politics. And, oh, this side believes in all these crazy theories. No, this side believes in all these crazy theories, all that. But at the end of the day, when you look at foundationally what that is about and the kind of fear that comes out of and the distrust or the confusion or the pain that comes out of some of the things that people believe, you may never believe the truth, even if it's staring you in the face, because right, psychologically, you just can't do it. And so you will tell yourself, well, this was tampered with. Well, I'm being lied to. Like, mm-hmm, at some point, you just may not ever accept it. And I think that's it, tragic, and it's a protective thing that happens to people who, you know, are damaged or self-damaged or however you want to think about it. I'm certainly not saying that the Moors are that, but I could understand if they have gone through their lives with this level of tragedy and confusion and attention, if they just can't ever see it any other way, like, who am I to judge them, you know?
Yeah, well, and listen, beyond the victim's family discussion, just in general, like, cognitive dissonance is not like a new internet buzzword. Like, it's a real thing. And I think that if we get like very clear, meaningful results from this DNA testing, I think that we will see like the extremity of cognitive dissonance in a lot of places. I mean, besides the victims' families, look at some of these content creators that, you know, there's, you know, guys like William Ramsey and Gary Meese and the guys that have written books and just made it their life's mission to prove in every way possible that the West Memphis Three are guilty. And if we get like very clear and obvious DNA results that they are innocent and someone else did this, I'm really curious how like a lot of people will react to it. Because I predict, just as you said, Janet, that there will be a lot of, it was tampered with. Like there will be not just a few, there will be many people that would refuse to accept very obvious results because they just can't. And that's, you know, that, you know, that what cognitive dissonance is, for those that don't, you're so committed to your position that you cannot accept that there's a problem with it. So you have to like dismiss, you know, new data comes in, new information comes in, and you just cannot. There's something in you that I cannot take in that new information and then change my position. I'm locked in no matter what. And unfortunately, I think we'll probably, you know, if that's the result, we'll probably see a lot of that. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
This summer, whatever you're watching, baseball, golf, soccer, racing, DraftKings has you covered for every single moment of it. The DraftKings Sports app is now available in all 50 states, bringing the game straight to your fingertips wherever you are. New DraftKings customers, sign up with code KSR. Spend $5 to get 150 in rewards within 14 days. Includes all markets. That's code KSR. In partnership with DraftKings, the crown is yours. Bet with DK Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 1-800-MY-RESET. Connecticut? Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino in Kansas, bet tax pass-through may apply in Illinois. 21 plus, void in Canada. Event contract trading with DraftKings predictions involves risk of loss. Availability varies. Predictions offer void in New York. Bet to get bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Trade to get prediction dollars that expire in 1 year. $50 in rewards issued every 7 days via click to claim for 14 days. One non-withdrawable reward redeemable. Terms at dkng.co/offer. Limited time offer.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Whereas, or maybe in addition, on the other side, if testing came back on something of Hayes and it just was a non, I would have a very hard time understanding logistically how and when that could have happened. But I wouldn't be like, no, it doesn't mean anything. Like, I refuse. No. I would be like, wow, okay, I don't know how this could have happened. Like, when did this happen?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say like, no, I'm, you know, like I would want to have to deal with
that. And I think you fall into the category of what I think is the majority of people are that are open minded. You know, people certainly will accuse me all the time of, you're just, you know, you're just trying to manipulate to your narrative, but that's not the case at all. In fact, like our season 14, where, you know, when the prosecutors went after Adnan and then I replied to them, my interest in what they were doing was not because, oh, I heard they're saying he's guilty. Let me figure out a way to undo it. I started listening to them because I was hearing people saying, I was seeing posts and people saying they're presenting new evidence that we've never seen before. And Adnan is definitely guilty. And I was like, well, then I need to hear it, because and my purpose was, if there's evidence that he's guilty that I haven't seen, then I need to, you know, take that in, consider it, and if I've been wrong, then I need to come on the podcast and admit that I was wrong.
Yeah.
Now what ended up happening was that I found out they were, you know, manipulating and lying about what they were putting out. But in any case, we can move on because we're already running along, and we've talked a lot of this. A lot about this stuff already, but let's move on to DM's post here, and we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, DM is another person who has really followed the Murder Sheets coverage of the case and felt very concerned about what Aaron was leaving out, and sort of goes through and lists some of the stuff, like you said, Bob, that we've sort of been talking about, and all of these things that have happened. So I think you had the opportunity to reach out to Aaron, or maybe you guys had already talked about this in advance, but that in reply to why aren't you talking about this, and the concern that all of that would be left out, didn't you mention to me that perhaps Aaron did have a reply to that?
Yeah, well, we talked about before this post came out, and we'll circle back too, because I didn't mean to skip over Sarah's. I literally scrolled past it and didn't see it. Sarah G's comment, if we want to kind of bullet point some of the details. But as far as that's concerned, you know, when we finished recording, Aaron was telling me that he's like, man, he's like, because again, he doesn't like all this online fighting and stuff. And he's like, people are just coming after me and they're like, well, you didn't say this and you didn't say this and you didn't say that. And what he said was, he's like, these people, like, they don't understand how storytelling works. Like, I thought I've made it very clear that I'm going through this chronologically. He's like, he's already recorded all 8 episodes. He said, all that stuff's coming.
Yeah.
But we're not there. He said, it doesn't make sense when I'm talking about what happened on the day of the murder to be like, oh, in 2010, this was found out. You know, eventually we'll get to 2010 and we'll talk about that. So if you're concerned that Aaron's going to be like, first of all, he doesn't have a dog in the fight. He's not doing this because he's trying to prove Temujin Kensu is innocent. He's just trying to present the facts of the case. He's certainly not going to be hiding anything. And a lot of things that people think he's going to like hold back, he's not. He's, you know, from what he told me, like he wants to present everything. And some of the things, so Sarah, I'll just read it because I made you skip it.
Sure.
Sarah G had said regarding in this case, and these are some of the things, right, that people are worried that weren't presented in the first 2 episodes of Aaron's show. It says, regarding the alibi witnesses, the way the prosecution got around the alibi was by introducing doubt about the validity of the alibi witnesses. They put witnesses on the stand who testified to Kensu's efforts to manipulate their memory about the day and or threatened them. And without the noon alibi witness, he had time to make the drive. No plane needed. It's also worth noting that Temujin knew Crystal and Scott were engaged, and he knew Crystal was pregnant, and he believed the baby was his. So for me, what I always try to do is separate. I call it noise. It feels like it's diminishing but it's, as far as like facts of the case, evidence that he did this, the part at the end of that about him knowing that she was pregnant and all that, like that is important because it speaks to a motive for sure. But that is not any evidence that he did this crime, right? So it's not like it gets thrown away. But what I'm trying to look at is from the basic facts, which is probably a little easier for me because I'm not invested in this case. So I'm just looking at like I want to know like, did he do it? How did he do it? How do we prove that he did it? Right. So that part is more to motive. I did look into the alibi witness thing, and it seems like some of that is a little bit overstated. So there were witnesses that testified at trial. Nobody testified at trial that I was able to find, and I didn't research this. You know, I researched what I could do in a couple hours. Nobody testified that he threatened anybody. There was testimony that he, or even that he tried to manipulate necessarily, but that
might have come from interviews after the fact, like interviews not in the case records, but
not in the trial.
Yeah, not in the trial, but actually in reporting directly with those people afterwards. I'm not sure.
So there were 9 independent witnesses who none of them were like friends of his, knew him, anything like that, that testified that he was in the UP up by Escanaba throughout the day on the day of the murders. Now the critical one that brings the airplane discussion in was there were 2 witnesses. I just wrote my notes, their last names, Manali and Dyer, that testified that he was at the martial arts studio, whatever that place was, at noon, that it was at 12 o'clock. He was there like during a class or something like that. And that's the part that makes it, you know, it's a minimum 6-hour drive. And Scott was killed at 9 a.m. So there's no way he could have been there at noon and have committed the crime. The other witnesses matter too. They're kind of paced throughout the day, but they're like, leave this like perfect, you know, where he could have left Escanaba at 2 o'clock in the morning, drove all night, got there, found him, shot him, and immediately drove all the way back and could have been back if there was like no traffic or issues and could have been back by like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And like, so some of the witnesses, it's like they saw him that day in the morning and the night, but there was enough of a gap there that it's possible. But the noon witnesses just blew everything out of the water. And the one guy, and I did not write down his name, but there was one guy that testified, was not one of the noon witnesses. It had to do with something with him, like dropping off like vitamins or something at his house. And it was, you know, it was some of the guy remembered his girlfriend dropped him off, and Temujin had called him, and he was like, well, you know, don't you remember I was there on that day and I did that? And he said, no, I don't remember. And he's like, well, maybe I was driving around the block, but I was there. And he's like, no, you weren't. So, I mean, that it's like you had mentioned earlier, Janet, right? So like it's what box are you putting that in? You can certainly, from an innocence argument, put in the box of, well, if the police were trying to pin this murder on me, I'm going to try to talk to anybody I possibly can. And, you know, maybe places I thought I was or whatever, but I'm going to try to get somebody to say I was there. If you're on the guilty side, it's like, well, he's trying to create an alibi that doesn't exist. But that guy didn't have anything to do with the noon alibi. The noon alibi was Manali and Dyer. And from what I read, it sounds like the murder sheet broke this down pretty well. And they actually explicitly said, from what I read on the show, that they believe that these two witnesses were sincere, that they believe what they said.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that they think that their memories were manipulated because they kind of were contaminated through like a collective reconstruction. So
mm-hmm.
from what I read, I wrote down this little kind of step-by-step what happened. So Manali, originally, he does remember, you know, he remembered Temujin being there at noon, but he wasn't sure on the date. He didn't know if it was like Monday or Tuesday, or if it was, you know, Temujin was saying it was Wednesday or whatever the day was. And Temujin was trying to say, no, it was the Wednesday. So Manali initially says he's not sure about the date. Kenzu calls him to try to jog his memory, and Manali still isn't sure. So then he calls this woman with the last name Dyer and asks her, and she's like, I do remember seeing him there. I don't remember if it was Monday or Wednesday, though, which class it was, Monday or Wednesday. She was unsure of the date also, but then Manali reminded her that she wasn't at class that Monday, so it had to have been Wednesday. And with that, you know, so it's kind of like he remembers he was there someday that week, doesn't remember what day. She says, yeah, I definitely saw him there. I go to class on Monday and Wednesday. I don't remember what day it was. He said, well, you didn't go Monday. So then it had to been Wednesday. So then they both said that it was on Wednesday the 5th by the time it was done. So I don't consider that to be like manipulative. I mean, there's actually like a good way to kind of reconstruct things. It's kind of like where you're finding these anchor points. Like if she truly only goes Monday and Wednesday and she wasn't there Monday, but you remember seeing him, then it had to be Wednesday. So, you know, I haven't dug deeply into it enough to be able to like say, so for sure he was there Wednesday. But I think that to say that it was, you know, based on him overstating, or I think it's overstated to say that he manipulated and threatened all these witnesses. Like, these are the two key, most important witnesses, and the way they got to their conclusion, from what I've read, based on their testimony. Now, I didn't read their testimony. I read reports on their testimony, so this could be inaccurate. They didn't land on Wednesday, November 5th, because Temujin convinced him of that. They landed on that day by talking to each other and like and tracking through their schedules about, you know, what day she was at class, what day she wasn't. If they did, they both remember seeing him. That's how they landed on that. I also want to point out, so there was, I think it was from the commutation hearing in 2010, the judge's decision, it was Judge Denise Page Hood. In her decision, she described the alibi witnesses as, quote, unrelated, unimpeachable, and more reliable than Michelle Woodworth, which I read that. And I think Michelle Woodworth was maybe one of the witnesses from the scene. I don't remember who she was. So, you know, it doesn't conclusively prove that these alibi witnesses to date, but I just want to point out the person, you know, a judge that, you know, heard directly from the witnesses that looked at the actual source material, felt that the alibi witnesses were, in her words, unimpeachable. Now,
that's the alibi witnesses. It's not the witnesses to the crime.
Right, the alibi. Yeah, it says specifically the trial alibi witnesses were, quote, unrelated. This is what I put in my notes.
I thought Michelle was his girlfriend. Again, I'm sure this is just making people who know the case better than us see.
Yeah, I don't remember who Michelle is.
Well, I mean, I think Michelle's really important. So I think not remembering who she is speaks volumes about how little we know the case.
Right. The point I'll make too is like everything that judge said after viewing this doesn't mean that it's still accurate, right? It means like they went to trial testifying, believing that what they're saying is true. That's essentially what this is. Now, could they still be wrong? Yes, they could still be wrong. For me, just from the strict investigator, not getting to any of the other elements of the case, like, I look at that, you know, you have these completely unrelated people, you know, people at like gas stations and restaurants and all these different places that are all saying he's around town. I think it makes it really, really difficult to convince me, you know, no one has shown me that they can put the gun in his hands. Nobody can show me he owned the gun. No, even if the Noon ones are right, there's so many witnesses that he was in Escanaba. Just the idea of just one Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the morning, or 1 o'clock, whenever, driving all night to find this guy at this exact place, shooting him and immediately driving all the way back. I mean, it does seem very, very unlikely. And I guess the bigger point I have is the reason I quoted the judge's decision.
And which judge was this? What was the context of this? Because he's not out. So it's not like it's a judge.
There was a commutation hearing in 2010. And I think that's what this is from.
But he didn't get it was, so the judge can't have thought he had enough to do that.
Right, yeah. It was 11-0. He didn't get the commutation. So, yeah, but part of the decision, the alibi witnesses were discussed.
And so the judge was like, his alibi witnesses are reliable, but I still think he should be in prison? I guess I don't understand that decision.
Well, it's a commutation hearing, right? So it's like, this isn't like a... And this may not. I should shut the hell up. Actually, because
maybe you should.
Well, I know that the commutation hearing was in 2010. And it was 11-0. And that's where we heard from all of, you know, his ex, the victim's girlfriend, all these people that were talking about all his abuse and all these different things. That the commutation hearing is to commute his sentence, like something that's going to the governor's desk, you know, kind of like a pardon, and you know, I guess it's not clemency or I don't know. It's different than a normal like PCR hearing as far as the birds were in a commutation hearing. From what I read, they can take into account like his character and all these other different things. Right. And they were like, no, this guy doesn't deserve to get out of prison,
I guess. But at the end of the day, if a judge is saying, I think the alibi witnesses were telling the truth and therefore he can't have been there to commit the crime, but I think he should still stay in prison. I don't know what to make of that.
Well, but that's kind of the point I'm getting at. The judge says the witnesses are unrelated, unimpeachable, and more reliable than Michelle Woodworth, right? So they're saying what that says to me is the judge believes that the alibi witnesses believe what they're saying.
Right.
What the judge didn't say is, and therefore he couldn't have been there, and therefore they must be right, right? So there's still there's still some nuance there that I think is real confusing to me, especially because I, for some reason, didn't write in my notes what hearing that was from, but the same year.
Okay, we gotta do our homework, because this is, I'm so scared that what this is like, I'm so scared that this is someone saying like, no, I'm saying the people who saw him in the UP are unimpeachable, because I think Michelle was another alibi of his that he was home. I don't know.
Might have been. I don't know. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make, if I could get my tongue untwisted, is that I think this opens up a more kinder discussion, because the sentiment is, well, you're ignoring, not from these particular people, but just in general, from everything else I'm reading online, right, is like, you're ignoring that these alibi witnesses clearly lied. And if a judge looked at it and looked at all this evidence and was like, I don't think that they lied, I just think that it's reasonable. That's all. The only place I was going with this is it's reasonable for somebody to have questions about the conviction based on the alibi witnesses, because there has been no evidence that they're wrong. That's the problem. And that's the problem that I have, always looking at it from trying to, you know, not just, you know, preponderance of evidence, but proving beyond a reasonable doubt that someone did something, I'm looking at a case where there's a whole lot of evidence that suggests that he was 6 to 8 hours away in the UP when this happened. There's no evidence that says he was there. There's no evidence that it was his gun, that he fired the gun. And just practically speaking, I think the whole idea of it happening this way is kind of bananas. It would make, again, not a case I would take because this isn't one where I'm like, I'm certain he's innocent and let's find who did it. But it's certainly a case where I'm like, ah, man, I'm real uncomfortable with the conviction. And the thing that frustrates me about this case, from what I, the little bit I know about it, is it sure seems like it should have been solvable. It shouldn't be this difficult. I feel like this is such a targeted, obvious attack on him, on Scott, that it should have been easily solvable. The fact that it takes this much complication about all these alibis and somebody so far away to solve it is frustrating to me because it seems like it should be easier. I don't feel like, from what I've read, the police did a real good job about digging into his victimology. I don't know anything.
I think they did, but I could be wrong. I just don't think he had much. I don't think there was that much to like dig. I mean, I think
I read that he
we
had
don't
some
know
kind
what we
conne-
don't know. We don't know what we don't
or
know.
Or wasn't I read? I think Aaron had said that he had some connection to this mayor. I don't know if there's because for all I know, and I'm not saying this is true, but like did he have a drug problem? Did he have a new drug problem? Because I heard Aaron saying that he was like suddenly having like he wasn't attending his classes as much as he used to. There was something going on that like. It makes me wonder, again,
well, maybe
I am
he knows
not
more about
this.
That. Maybe Aaron has uncovered something. Because again, like,
yeah, I have no
delighted
idea.
To have Kevin come on, because I know they spoke to people who, like, they sort of address, I believe they address the kind of the drug rumor stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if there was drug rumors. I just, to me, yeah. That's when I was listening to it, I'm like, okay, there's something changing in this man's life. Something's going on. And then he just got shot in cold blood.
Yeah.
If we're only focused on trying to build a case around Temujin, that's what. But let's say that, let's just go from ground zero. If I'm looking at it, it's like, okay, something's changed his life. Something's going on. Somebody targeted him. I want to know everything about what's going on in his life.
Yeah. What you'll hear is that the main thing going on in his life was that he felt very much threatened by Temujin and very much at risk because of Temujin. And that was like a known thing that had been established before this happened. So like, mm-hmm. It wasn't just one person who was like, hey, I bet it was this person. It was like, I think it was out there that he thought this was happening to him. So it's could be understood why if someone says, hey, if anything happens to me, it was this person. The police then go, well, gosh, he was just shot in cold blood and he himself was afraid this was going to happen. We better look at the person that he was afraid it was going to happen because of. It's hard to be mad at the cops for that, you know. But we have to be willing to walk away from this knowing that there's a lot that we don't, you know, we just haven't had time to dig into. And we know that there are people who have in every direction, in literally every, you know, in mm-hmm. on all sides of this. But it's fascinating. Again, I'll be interested to see how I feel at the end of Framed. And also after I complete listening to the murder sheet, because my biggest fear is that I'm still going to be like, I'm going to be wrestling with my own feelings about like, can I just focus on someone who I think is like morally okay?
Yeah, right.
And that's something I have to contend with about myself, you know?
Yeah. And with that said, like I said, I think it's a good place to wrap it up. Let's hope, as I mentioned at the beginning, I don't know who we're going to have this week. I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that who we'll have on Sunday would be awesome if we could have like Kevin from Murder Sheet come on. And somebody, I think Meg or somebody in the chat earlier asked if there was, she thought that we had some kind of beef with Murder Sheep. We don't. I don't know them. I've never met them. I've only listened to a few of their episodes when there was a case that I was covering. There was some miscommunication over the Delphi case where I thought I'd reached out to them. I think we can chalk it up to a miscommunication. In any case, they've done a ton of work. They've talked to a lot of people in this case. I would love to have them come on. One or both of them, and just so I can ask them a lot of questions, because I always like having somebody from, you know, with I can't even say a different perspective, because I don't know that Aaron's has landed on Temujin is innocent.
Yeah, maybe not. I've had a lot of exchanges with Kevin. I consider us pals at this point. I feel that he's very respectful and is very interested in kind of turning down the temperature. We all feel like some of us feel like we've contributed to. So
I'm not interested in having an argument with anybody. I'd like to have a conversation, though. So hopefully that's what we are able to do. So hopefully that'll be coming up soon. We're over an hour. Poor Erica. We better end this thing.
Erica, we love you.
Talk to you guys next
listeners,
week.
Listeners, we love you.
Bye, guys. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
It's called soccer.
It's called football.
Soccer.
Football.
Domino's Best Deal Ever lets you get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, fully.
So, pineapple? Don't ruin it. Get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99. Finally, something everyone can get behind.
And if the refs disagree, that's between them and Domino's. Which means the only thing left to fight over is who's ordering.
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6:15 to 7:26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings. 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.